TSMC is at the forefront of driving advanced technology forward. At the TSMC North America Technology Symposium, the company highlighted its latest semiconductor process, advanced packaging, and 3D IC stacking technologies, all designed to power the AI revolution. The showcase technologies are aimed at improving system performance, reducing power consumption, and optimizing design space, all of which are crucial for those working on groundbreaking technological innovations.
The politics of the Israel-Hamas war have become one of the most divisive issues in the Democratic Party. The presidential primaries, which were supposed to be a coronation for Joe Biden, have been marked by organized protests against the president's pro-Israel policies. Chuck Schumer's recent speech condemning Bibi Netanyahu thrilled progressives, but angered some pro-Israel Democrats. Elsewhere in Congress, placing restrictions on aid to Israel has a growing constituency in the party. Democrats are also bracing for large protests outside their convention in Chicago this summer, and perhaps inside as well if a big platform fight over Israel breaks out. And then there are the primary battles, where the two sides of this debate are facing off. One increasingly prominent group to watch is the Democratic Majority for Israel, which has a list of House Democrats who the group sees as hostile to Israel and is targeting for defeat. President of the Democratic Majority for Israel is Mark Mehlman, a longtime Democratic pollster, and he's our guest this week. We get into the weeds on the new politics of Israel within the Democratic Party. And we also talk about every other big polling question that's front and center in 2024. Biden's age, Trump's hold on the GOP, double doubters, abortion, the fate of Nikki Haley voters, and whether you should bother paying attention to polls in the first place. I'm Ryan Lizza. This is Playbook Deep Dive. Let's start with Israel and the politics of Israel and the numbers. We recently had Veronica Escobar on this show from El Paso. She said that she thought that Gaza was the Democrats' biggest vulnerability. Do you agree that it's as big a problem or a bigger problem than, say, the border or Biden's age? Do you think it is that kind of issue for the president?
Yeah, I think there's absolutely no evidence of that whatsoever. Yeah. The reality is we've asked people whether they approve or disapprove of the way the president's handling this war. And the truth is the majority of people say they disapprove of the way he's handling this war. We ask them why.
You're asking Dems, is this a Dems only question or everyone?
Everyone.
Yeah.
But we ask people why. And whether we're talking about Democrats or we're talking about the public at large, the largest number say they don't like the way he's handling it, but it has nothing to do with the with which side he's on. The next largest number think he's too pro-Palestinian. And the smallest number think he's too pro-Israel. So it's not being supportive of Israel that's the problem. It's something else. And the reality is when we ask people whether they more likely to vote for the president because of what he's done in this war, vote against the president because of what he's done in this war, more people are likely to vote for him than against him. Most people say, you know what, it really doesn't matter to me. There's not too many people who say, you know what, the economy doesn't really matter to me.
Right.
There's not too many people who say age issues don't really matter to me. There's not too many people saying democracy doesn't matter to me. But there's the largest majority of people in this country are saying, you know what, when it comes to voting for president, this war in Gaza doesn't matter to me.
I think so. I think the argument on their side, on the left side, that this is an important political issue for Biden, and we're really just talking about the sort of crass politics of it right here, is that given the margins in Michigan, the communities that are the most upset about Biden's policy are in that crucial swing state where not a lot of votes can decide the election, could decide the entire election. And then if you get into the subcategories that he's that Biden is weak with, and I want to talk to you about this in general, so maybe you don't agree with this, but it does seem like non-white voters and especially younger non-white voters are showing much less support for Biden than at this stage in 2020. And those also seem to be groups that have some overlap with being more sympathetic to Palestinians and what's going on right now. So I think that's sort of the argument is Michigan, young voters, non-white voters.
Yeah. So look, there is no problem.
And obviously, just for listeners, obviously in Michigan, because it has very large Muslim and Arab American populations.
It does. But the truth is, if you look at the exit polls, it's about 1% of the electorate.
Yeah.
So it's large compared to other places.
1% of the Michigan electorate.
1% of the Michigan electorate is Muslim American. So it's large compared to other places. In Nevada, Muslims register 0% of the electorate. So much larger than that.
Yeah.
But not really very large. For example, the Jewish community in Michigan is about 2% of the electorate. In Nevada, it's about 4% of the electorate. So you have to look at this in a number of different ways. First, is he really losing support among these groups because of this issue? Again, there just is not evidence of that. There's evidence that he's lost support among those groups. But there's really no evidence, and again, we've asked the questions directly, there's no evidence it's because of this that he's lost support from those groups. Those younger voters, for example, no question, much less pro-Israel.
You don't think that, and you're talking specifically about the Muslim American and Arab American groups?
No, you
moved on to the other two. Got it.
Okay. Well, I'm going to come back to the Muslim Americans for a second. But with those younger voters, for example.
They don't see the evidence there.
You don't. And they're telling us that the economic issues are what's really most important to them, telling us that in poll after poll after poll. So, again, there just isn't a lot of evidence that segment is really, as a group, they're not pro-Israel, as pro-Israel as their elders are, those younger voters. We definitely have problems with them, but they're not saying that they're voting against Joe Biden because of this issue. The Arab American voter, potentially different situation, no question about it. Muslim Americans, very different. My point about them is really twofold. First of all, as I say, it is in fact a relatively small, it's threefold points actually. It's a relatively small proportion of the electorate, number one. Number two, it is very hard for me to imagine that, and I don't speak for the Muslim community obviously in any way, shape or form, but it's hard for me to understand as an analyst that a Muslim American is going to go vote for the Islamophobe in chief, Donald Trump, against Joe Biden, the guy who instituted a Muslim ban, the guy who wants to deport Palestinians today or tomorrow when he becomes president and deport Palestinians from this country. People aren't going to vote for him. Now, the natural first response, people say, well, they may not vote for Trump, but maybe they don't vote at all, or maybe they vote for Cornel West or whatever. Certainly possible. But again, the closer we get to this election, the clearer it's going to be to everyone that if you were otherwise a Biden voter, who votes for a third party or stays home, you're voting for Trump. And that's going to be very clear to the Muslim community. It's going to be very clear to the Jewish community. It's going to be very clear to every community that cares about preventing Donald Trump from taking back the White House. The third point is that one has to understand all sides of the equation here, which is to say, you know, is it possible that you lose some Muslim voters or some younger voters? It's possible. Is it possible you gain some other voters? Yes, it is.
Where would you see the gain?
Well, so for example, evangelical Christians are 26% of Michigan. 28% of them voted for Joe Biden last time. If that got to 30 or 31 or 32%, that would more than cancel out any change, 100% change in the Muslim American vote. So there are other groups and segments that are important, but it's also important to look at it from the inside or the inside out, which is to say, if the president changes his position, he loses votes not only from the pro-Israel community, from the pro-Israel side, but he loses votes from people who say, wait a second, that guy waffles so much that he would change his position on this issue because of 10% of the voters in Michigan. So,
well, I think we got to be specific about what we mean on the changes the issue, because what is the position that Joe Biden could or has come off of that would make those groups that you're talking about now, more skeptical? Is it telling Israel that a ceasefire is in there? You know, like, do you see him having already moved in a way that could cost him with these other groups you're talking about?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
But could he move in a way that could cost him? Yes, of course.
How so? Where would this go in that? I guess what you're talking about is some sort of bigger break with Israel.
Yes. And for example, one could, I don't want to give people ideas here, but one could say, you know, we're going to not going to oppose this additional aid to Israel that's being discussed in Congress. The president's been a huge advocate of that. If he says, well, wait a second, I've changed my mind. We're not going to send any money to Israel. That would be a major change and deeply problematic.
But
I don't think he's going to – I don't think there's any chance he's going to do that.
Where you do see hints of it, though, is talking – is the discussion around conditions on the aid has become – gone much further than in previous debates about aid to Israel.
Yes, it has in the Congress.
Yeah.
The president said long ago that it was, quote, a terrible idea when Bernie Sanders proposed it.
Long ago is the key phrase there.
A while ago. But he hasn't changed that position. The reality is there are conditions on the aid. The question is, should there be additional political conditions on the aid?
Yeah.
And there are conditions already in the U.S. law, and there are conditions that he put on in the National Security Memorandum. And we'll see how what he decides on this. But so far, the recommendation seems to be that Israel is abiding by international law. That's what the international law experts say, and that's what the U.S. ambassador on the ground says, and we'll see in a couple of days whether the president says that as well. But I think that will be the position of the administration.
But the big change that you see is if he abandons in any way support for the aid or just says or doesn't.
Well, that's certainly one thing. I mean, there's lots of other ways you could signal that as well, but that would certainly be one important way that's coming up shortly.
Obviously, perhaps the biggest seismic change that I think I've seen in the years of covering this debate is Chuck Schumer's speech about Israel the other day. How did you – I'm sure you know Schumer quite well. I'm sure you've known him for many years. Tell us about any insights you had into him making that speech, if you know, and what was your reaction?
So I think it's important to start with two points. One is – that Chuck Schumer has a long, strong pro-Israel record.
You know, that's why it's such a big deal.
It is. And second, I think it's fair to say if you read the whole speech, it was much more balanced and nuanced than the coverage of the speech.
Fair.
I mean, I think it is a much more balanced and nuanced document. On the other hand, or at the same time, I have to tell you, a lot of people in the pro-Israel community were deeply concerned, deeply hurt, and angry about aspects of that speech. Well, let me give you a couple of the points. One has to ask, when was the last time an American leader has gone to a democracy and said, have an early election, change your election date because I don't like the person who's running your country? We tend not to do that. Yeah. When Donald Trump was running our country, nobody came and said, hey, change your election schedule so you have another election. That's one thing that was, I think, very disturbing to people. But it wasn't the only thing. And
what were the other ones?
So, for example, I'm an anti-Bibi guy, okay? I've worked against Bibi successfully, sometimes unsuccessfully others. But I'm not a pro.
How many campaigns have you worked on in Israel?
Five or six, seven, wow. Something like that.
Bibi's probably been in every one of them.
Yes, he's been in every one of them, and he's been on the other side in every one of them. So I'm not really a pro-Bibi guy. But to put Bibi Netanyahu on the same level as Hamas as an obstacle to peace is not correct. It's not accurate, and it's certainly not helpful.
You believe this? There was a moral equivalence embedded in that speech.
Well, he said there are four obstacles to peace. Hamas was one. Netanyahu was another. That's putting them on the same level. And again, there was more nuance in the speech, and he made it clear in the speech that he understood why Israelis were so angry and so upset and so concerned about Hamas's attack, sympathized with that totally. But at the end of the day, when you say there are four obstacles and you put them all on the same level, that's a problem. There's also the signal it sends to Israel's enemies. We saw already when the administration trying to negotiate the ceasefire and before Schumer's speech, there was – when senators, members of Congress were going out talking about ceasefire and so on and so forth and attacking Biden for his policies. Hamas went to the negotiations and Hamas leaders pulled them back from the negotiations and said, let's wait. Let's not do the ceasefire because there's a split coming between Israel and the United States.
Yeah.
Well, imagine what's happening now in Iran, in Tehran, with Hezbollah, with Hamas as well. What are they saying to themselves? So unintended consequence for sure. So that's yet another problem. And finally, as somebody who knows something about Israeli politics, I worry that the speech was counterproductive. It was designed to hurt Bibi. It more likely to help him than hurt him.
Because why? Because there's a sort of sense in Israel that there shouldn't be that kind of interference?
Well, for that's certainly part of it, but it goes beyond that. The reality is Bibi was in terrible trouble in Israel.
Right.
He's Mr. Security, but the worst terrorist attack in the history of the country happened on his watch. It's hard to be Mr. Security and have that happen on your watch.
Yeah.
So people were anxious to get rid of him. And also he's been very divisive on this judicial reform issues and so on.
Sure, yeah.
So
yeah.
More than half the country was ready to get rid of him already. And now just about everybody's ready to get rid of him. But his part of the secret of his campaigning is to say, you know what? The Europeans, the Americans, the whoever want us to do things that you don't want to do. And I'm the only one that's going to stop him. The rest of these characters are going to give in to the Americans. I'm tough enough to stand up to them. Well, when you create the difference and say I'm going to stand up to them credibly, that's counterproductive. When Gantz goes back to Israel and can't now call for elections because he can't look like Chuck Schumer's toady or Joe Biden's toady for that matter, and so he. Gantz, who's also in the opposition, although part of the war cabinet supporting the government during the war, but goes back and says what Schumer said was completely wrong and unacceptable. And that
doesn't help. That. It doesn't help Bibi's opponents is what you're saying.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let's talk about the uncommitted vote in the primaries and whether and what you make of that. It does seem there was no coincidence that on the eve of the Michigan uncommitted or on the eve of the Michigan primary, Biden, maybe not for the first time, but very emphatically used the word ceasefire. And it did, as you know, there was a lot of turbulence between some of the Muslim American and Arab American leaders in Michigan and Biden world. A lot of leaders there, activists were put off by the fact that he sent some campaign folks out to Michigan to meet with them. He then sent foreign policy advisors out there. If you talk to people like Ro Khanna, he will say Biden has changed because of the pressure on this issue from the left. There's a lot to unpack there, but to the extent that we in the media have played up this uncommitted vote as something significant. Do you think it's overstated? Do you think there's anything to worry about?
I think it was vastly overstated. It's fascinating to me. Every data journalist said this is no big deal. Okay, the people, you know, the Nate Silvers, the Kyle Condicts, the people who focus on data,
yeah,
and analysts of data said, you know what? Uncommitted got 2.5% more in this year with a huge campaign than it did against Barack Obama when he had no opponent and nobody was asking for an uncommitted vote. So
yeah, in 2012.
Yeah. So everybody, all the data journalists said meaningless.
Yeah.
All the storytelling journalists wanted to tell a big story and they did irrespective of the facts.
So and since Michigan, obviously this is – there has been a surge of uncommitted organizing around this issue, whether it's uncommitted or, you know, leave it blank or Marianne Williamson in Arizona. The totality of it does not impress you?
I would say it's a little more impressive after Michigan, but that's in part because of the intense coverage that Michigan got.
Yeah,
the media contributed to that 20% in Minnesota. But the other thing is, nobody knows.
So that you think was insignificant? The Minnesota 20% you think was significant?
I mean, that's a bigger number.
Yeah.
But I'm a numbers guy, right? 20% bigger than 12%. But the other thing that's true, though, is nobody, not that night, not today, not next week, will have the slightest idea of how many people were voting uncommitted because of Israel,
because
of Gaza.
Right.
No idea. We just don't know what those numbers are. Nobody does, but everybody's making an assumption about it.
All right, fair. Let's talk about some of the potential primaries where this issue might be important and what your organization may or may not do. What's the goal?
So, look, our goal is to protect pro-Israel champions who are being challenged by anti-Israel figures in many cases.
You had a victory last Tuesday in Illinois, I believe, right?
Yes, and one in Texas, Lizzie Fletcher, against a guy who made anti-Israelism sort of the centerpiece of his campaign. But yes, we've had a number of victories over the last weeks. So that's one part of it. The second part is where we can to defeat some of these anti-Israel incumbents. There are very few of them to begin with, and there are even fewer who are vulnerable.
Let's go through them. Who's on your target list?
Well, you have to look, I think, at Jamal Bowman and Cori Bush and say those are the two that are the most vulnerable, not just because of their own, not just because of this issue, but because they also have other problems additionally, and because both of them have opponents who are serious elected officials in their own rights with substantial constituencies. And then you have a couple that don't seem to be vulnerable. Rashida Tlaib, for example, I think doesn't have an opponent at this moment. So not going to beat somebody with nobody.
Have you guys tried to do any candidate recruiting in these
races? No, we have not. Yeah. And then Ilhan Omar last time almost lost. This time, but last time she spent a lot of money on her husband's firm and didn't do any of the normal things that one does in a campaign, like run TV ads or send out direct mail or do phone calls or organizing. I don't think she's going to make that mistake again. You also had in Minneapolis last time this defund the police measure that she was backing, which lost overwhelmingly. And in the white heat of that race, I think there was some spillover, especially given the fact that she was not doing any campaigning of her own. So she's, I think, in a stronger place than she was before. AOC in a relatively strong place. The person in the middle is Summer Lee. I think it's hard to know in Pennsylvania. I think it's hard to know exactly how vulnerable she is at the moment, and we'll be looking at that.
So those are way down. But for now, Bowman and Bush.
Bowman and Bush certainly are at the top of the list.
There is a sense among a lot of Democrats I talk to that the convention in Chicago is going to be torn apart because of this issue, whether it's inside with delegates or outside with street protests or perhaps both. A little too on the nose that this is happening in Chicago. But what's your – I'm sure you've heard these same predictions. And what's your sense of that?
Well, I certainly hope it isn't the case. And having a divisive convention hurts Joe Biden. It helps Donald Trump. And I hope to God that people are not going to help Donald Trump even unintentionally by – putting on those kinds of demonstrations. But look, it's not going to be the pro-Israel people that are tearing the convention apart. It's going to be the anti-Israel people that are tearing the convention apart. It's the anti-Israel people. If there are violent street protests, so it's not our folks. There's nothing we can do about it except hope and pray that people understand the importance of this election and aren't willing to throw it to Donald Trump just to be able to perform on the streets of Chicago or in the convention hall.
Inside the convention hall, do you anticipate a serious platform fight on issues around this issue?
We had a platform battle last time. We may have a platform battle.
Remind people, I said that was in 2020?
In 2020.
And what was the nature of that? I don't remember.
It was a sort of insider kind of mostly insider.
But it was over support for Israel.
It was over support. The Sanders delegates wanted to have some different language in the platform. We wanted to keep it the way it was. President Biden, but then candidate Biden, but President Biden decided with us, and he had the delegates, and he's got the overwhelming number of delegates here. So
what's percolating on this summer?
I imagine there'll be some people who want to, and some delegates who want to make changes to the platform or want to move it in an anti-Israel direction. But at the end of the day, it's going to be up to the president to make that decision. We're certainly going to do everything we can to help him make sure the decision comes out the way we want it to. But at the end of the day, it's a president's decision, and I think the delegates will bend to the will of the president.
Just specifically, what's the thing that you're worried about? What's the kind of change that's percolating?
Don't know yet. I mean, again, you could imagine new conditions on aid. You could imagine no aid, people saying there should be no aid. I mean, you could imagine people saying all kinds of things. You can imagine people saying, we should support Hamas.
Yeah.
or that we should allow Hamas to continue to rule Gaza, because that is the end game of what these folks are suggesting.
TSMC is at the forefront of driving advanced technology forward. At the TSMC North America Technology Symposium, the company highlighted its latest semiconductor process, advanced packaging, and 3D IC stacking technologies, all designed to power the AI revolution. The showcase technologies are aimed at improving system performance, reducing power consumption, and optimizing design space, all of which are crucial for those working on groundbreaking technological innovations.
Let's talk about Biden and what the polling does and doesn't say. I want to, young voters, black voters, and Latino voters seem to be the groups. But tell me if I'm missing something. And how serious is this deterioration? I mean, I know you've written recently about being very careful when you're pulling out doing crosstab diving and with these small samples. But it does seem like there's enough evidence now where this is a serious concern for Biden.
Well, look, I would say a couple of things are true. First of all, we've gone from a situation where Biden in the last election led to a situation where he's tied, essentially. So somebody's got to have moved somewhere. And it is importantly the groups that that you've just articulated that where we've seen somewhat greater movement.
Young voters, black voters, Hispanics.
Yes.
Okay.
Those are groups where we've seen some movement. But again, there's a need that I think the president is filling here to, first of all, tell those folks what the president has accomplished. And he did that in the State of the Union, started that process in a major way. And I think that's going to it started actually with ads even before the State of the Union. And there'll be a lot more ads to come and a lot more speeches and a lot more activity telling people what the president's done. Second, until recently, it was not 100% clear to everybody in the country that Donald Trump was going to be the nominee. And Donald Trump was defined only by his legal issues. Now he's talking about a bloodbath. He's doing all the Trumpian things that he does, and it's getting attention. And it focuses the public mind on what's wrong with Donald Trump. And there are a lot of people in this country who think there's a lot wrong with Donald Trump, and that's being reinforced for them as well by Trump's actions and by the fact that he's in the public eye. So yes, have people moved? Of course, that's how we went from +4, +5 to tied. But there's still the opportunity to move those people back.
Let me just ask this more broadly about the general election. What do you see as Biden's greatest weakness and strength from a pollster's perspective? And the same question about Trump.
So look, there's no question that Biden's greatest weakness is the sense of age that has surrounded him. Obviously, the truth is Donald Trump is not meaningfully less old than Joe Biden. And Donald Trump has severe, I think it's fair to say, severe psychological and mental impairments.
Do you think Democrats should talk about that more?
Yes.
In that way?
I do.
Yeah.
And he called his wife.
Give me the litany. Like, what do you think, if you're Joe Biden, what would you be telling him to do?
And I don't think the president should be doing this.
Okay.
But I'll tell you what I'm going to say. The man didn't even remember his wife's name. Now, he's had a lot of wives and a lot of affairs, so you might forgive him for not even remembering his wife's name. But it's pretty strange not to remember your wife's name, to think your wife is named Mercedes. And it's pretty weird to identify the victim of your rape many years ago as your wife, as he did. So, look, there's a lot of evidence of these impairments. Democrats, not the president, but other Democrats can and should be talking about this. But the reality is he's going to display it. He's going to show it to everybody. Donald Trump is, because he can't help it. It's a problem he has.
And what's Biden's, from a polling perspective, what is his greatest strength? Going to the election in general.
Look, his strength is that he empathizes with people, and people perceive that. And historically, There's nothing that's been more important in sort of people's ultimate political judgment than who really cares about them. And Joe Biden is somebody who really cares about them, and people understand and believe that.
And for Trump, what is his greatest strength right now?
It's hard to identify the one, but there obviously is. His greatest strength is that he is not Joe Biden. At a moment when people are questioning the president's leadership.
Yeah.
There are hardcore Donald Trump voters for sure. And he has real strength with them because they believe that he is willing to suffer the slings and arrows of the establishment in order to articulate the views that they have.
Do you think the indictments have politically had the effect of, similar to how impeachment helped Bill Clinton in a sense over time? Do you think that, I know you can't run the counterfactual, but do you, yes. you think absent the indictments, it would be in a different situation or?
It's really hard to know. It's really hard to know. I will say I think the poll questions people ask about, well, if he's convicted, will you?
Yeah, I want you to talk about this because I think this is interesting. And let me just set it up. There is this stream of polling that says, and we just did one on Monday on the Bragg case. But there is a stream of polling that says that asks voters if Trump is convicted, will it change your view? You know, the wording changes, but in general, the totality of these polls is, if there's a conviction, it's really bad for him. And voters who say they support him now, some percentage, depending on the poll, are going to flip against him. And you think this is bullshit.
I think the questions are bullshit. It may or may not happen that way. But we know from a lot of experience now that these questions do not necessarily measure reality. What do I mean by that? So after the during the last campaign, during Trump's first campaign, there was a period at which half of Republican women said they would not vote for Donald Trump. Yet they did. We saw this with Bill Clinton's impeachment. People said, well, if he had sex with Monica Lewinsky, should he resign? They said, oh, yes, of course he should resign. Then it became clear that he did have sex with Monica Lewinsky. And people said, no, he shouldn't resign. And then they said, well, if he lied about it, should he resign? Should he be impeached? And yes, of course. And then it was clear he lied about it. People said, no, he shouldn't be impeached. And then they said, well, the question was, if he's impeached, should he resign or should he stay and fight? Oh, he should resign. And then he was impeached. People said, no, he should stay and fight. So
they updated their views at every turn.
Exactly.
And they were very bad at predicting how they would actually – either they didn't want to tell the pollster or they were just bad at predicting how they'd feel.
And I think the honest truth is people are very bad at putting themselves into an alternative reality and predicting how they're going to respond to some set of facts in an alternative reality. They have hard enough predicting what they're going to have for dinner tonight, let alone how they're going to react to some new situation, some alternative reality.
So as a poll consumer – what's your when questions are worded that way, beware,
don't pay any attention.
Yeah, I would say some of your polling at the beginning of this conversation about Israel Gaza could fall in under that rule, because you're asking voters who don't know a lot about the ins and outs, you know.
Well, that's true, but the difference is we're not asking to project themselves into an alternative reality. We're saying the reality you're in, you disapprove of the president.
Well, do you agree with a ceasefire, and then you add some conditional statements to it?
Oh, sorry. So in that case, we're saying, should we have a ceasefire, immediate permanent ceasefire, or should we only have an immediate permanent ceasefire if Hamas is disarmed and dismantled, hostages are released? Those are – you're setting up alternatives, conditions for people, and asking them which condition they prefer. That's different than asking them to project their behavior in some future unknown reality.
I don't know if you saw it, but did you see the poll that we had with Ipsos on Monday about the – but in general, if you see a poll saying if Trump gets convicted in the Bragg case, which is considered maybe the least, serious one, you don't put a lot of stock in that.
I don't. Yeah. I don't think people are good at predicting their behavior.
Why do pollsters still ask questions like this if it's a sort of –
Because the people that pay for the polls think they're interesting.
Well, that's touche. What are the other – are there any other categories that are you just roll your eyes out in terms of polling that gets a lot of coverage? Like what are the other bad questions out there these days that dominate the conversation?
Well, that's a good question. I'll go back to the ceasefire question. When you say to people, do you favor a ceasefire, yes or no?
Right.
It's like asking, do you want world peace? Unless you sort of describe the circumstances, the effects, the conditions, you don't really have anything that's very useful. So that's another example of the kind of questions that are not very good. And look, we all do this because we get paid to do it, but and that is to ask people about arcane pieces of legislation that they know nothing about and get them to say yes so that our clients can forward that material all over the world, known world.
We get about three of those a day at Playbook.
Yes, I'm sure you do. I'm sure you do. But it's like, one of the things the consumer should look for on those kinds of issue questions is do the questions reflect the realities? You have to make sure the parameters that are in the question are similar to the actual public policy parameters at stake.
All right, one more on the same topic. The one where we're asking voters to predict how they will feel months down the line that is getting a lot of attention or has gotten a lot of attention in the recent Republican primaries is Nikki Haley voters being asked, will they support Trump if he's the nominee? And these numbers are big in some of these states and these exit polls of Nikki Haley voters saying, no way, I'm not supporting him. There's all kinds of conversation about how Biden should be studying those voters very carefully. That's the universe of potential Republican primary voters that's available to him. Do you put any stock in those of the Nikki Haley Republicans, you know, saying in November that they won't vote for Trump, or the partisan inclinations kick in and they all come home?
Great question. And it's a little hard to know because we don't have quite the same experience that directly matches that. But I would say a couple things. First of all, previous presidential elections. Yeah.
But we had it with, I don't know, like the Pumas and Obama, right? I do remember exit polls asking similar questions in hard fought Democratic and Republican primaries where the aggrieved the aggrieved voters of the losing candidate said similar things. No?
Yeah. Well, again, let me go back a step.
Yeah.
First of all, some of those people are not Republicans who are voting in these Republicans.
On the Nikki Haley question.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. They're Nikki Haley voters who
are independents or Democrats who decided to vote in a Republican primary because they didn't like Trump and there was no action on the Democratic side or whatever. So it's a somewhat unique circumstance in that respect. Second, what you would normally expect is for those people to retreat to their partisan predispositions. So the real Republicans among those people are likely to end up in the Trump category. The independents, the Democrats, not as likely to vote to end up in the Trump category. So exactly how those are parsed out is important, and I don't know the answer to that because I haven't really done the deep dive in the exits to see. But the other question you have to ask yourself is, if 25-40%, whatever the number is, it varies from poll to poll. But if some huge number of Haley voters are not going to vote for Trump, where are they in the polls that ask people who they're voting for now? They're voting for Trump, or else he wouldn't have the support he does.
Right, right, right. I guess the other question is, what state is it? The number was pretty big in South Carolina, but I don't think Biden's going to win South Carolina
exactly.
No matter what.
Right. Well, that's an electoral college question. Exactly. Some states don't, you could lose all those voters and still.
It's not going to turn into a swing state.
I think it's fair to say that you could lose all the Nikki Haley voters in South Carolina and it would be a swing state probably, but nobody believes it's South Carolina is going to be a swing state.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're right. It's not going to be.
One other issue polling issue that's getting a lot of attention is the focus on double doubters.
Yes.
Do you, What is your analysis of this group, and what are the questions we should be looking at as we discuss this for the next, you know, so many, however many months we're going to be discussing it?
Well, so
is it as important? Is this the key to the election?
It is in an arithmetic sense, which is to say that there are not enough Trump lovers or Biden lovers to give either one a majority. So the people who are going to decide the election just arithmetically are the people who don't like either one of them. They may like one of them better than the other, and that's what you don't get from a lot of these analyses is, you know, I may have a very unfavorable impression of Trump and an only somewhat unfavorable impression of Biden. That makes me more likely to be a Biden voter than a Trump voter, and we don't get that from most of these
polls. You can ask that. You can ask with that kind of detail.
Yes, we do it all the time.
Yeah.
So just arithmetically, these people who are essentially don't like either one are going to decide the election. But that's not new. That was true 4 years ago as well. The number of people who were positively disposed to either one of them was not a majority, and the majority only came with the people who disliked both. So it's not a new phenomenon by any stretch of the imagination. It arises because we have such strong negative feelings about our candidates these days on both sides. So and we have a lot of people who don't like both. So that gives that – empowers that group. But figuring out how to deal with them is important. But I don't have any particular guidance at the moment except to say, as I said before, some of them may actually be leaning in one direction or the other.
How important is it that they do or don't have third-party options?
Look, I think that third-party options, I think, work to the detriment of President Biden. I think the polling shows that.
Is it particularly important to this group? Because if you hate both of the candidates, then
why not vote for the third party? Exactly. So I think
arguably that cost Hillary the election in 2016.
Yes, I think it did. And but I don't think this is firmly set in cement yet. I think that the third party vote always goes down as we get closer to the election. And again, people realize that if you are a Biden voter who's would normally be a Biden voter who's not voting for Biden, or a Trump voter who isn't voting for Trump, that you're voting for the other guy if you vote for these third party candidates. It is a danger. There's no question about it. I think it's a greater danger to President Biden than it is to Donald Trump. I think there's no question about that either. But just how big a danger it is, I think, is really not clear because the polls are pretty mixed about this.
Got it. One other issue I don't just want to get your thoughts on in terms of polling and Democratic strategy is abortion and reproductive rights. The people who are more bullish on Biden will point to special elections, the midterms, and a presidential election, a good run here, and especially post Dobbs. How do you think this plays for Biden in the fall, and how do you think Democrats can take advantage of it in the context of a presidential campaign? And is it different than in any ways from these recent elections, where it's been obviously very successful for Democrats?
Yes, and look, we did the campaign in Michigan for the constitutional amendment that enshrined abortion rights in Michigan's constitution, and there is no question that it had an impact on turnout and an impact on people's actual voting behavior, not just on our measure, but up and down the ballot.
It drove Democratic turnout.
Drove higher Democratic turnout, and it drove people to vote for Democrats who might not otherwise have. The question is, will that force have the same level of ferocity in 2 years later? And I think that's not altogether clear. I think it's going to be an important issue. I think choice will be an important issue. I think people clearly don't like the idea of government making these decisions instead of women and their families. But just how strong that will be 2 years after Dobbs, or maybe three, I can't remember exactly when Dobbs happened. But
22.
Yeah. So years afterwards, not so clear. But I think Democrats would do well to focus on the issue. There's no question about it. Exactly how powerful it'll be compared to the midterms, that remains to be seen.
Is there any way to tell if there's a trade-off here with Democrats' emphasis on this? I mean, Kamala Harris went to a clinic that provides abortion services recently. I don't remember any president or vice presidential candidate doing that.
I think it was a smart move.
But there's always trade-offs, right?
There are always trade-offs. But what the people who are anti-choice have gone to the Democrat – I'm sorry, have left the Democratic Party and gone to the Republican Party a while ago.
I mean, I guess what the Republicans will say is, this is why Catholic Hispanics, there's an opportunity. I mean, they've been saying this for years, really, that, you know that's one subgroup is religious voters who have stuck with Democrats.
I've heard that argument. The problem is it doesn't match well with the facts. The Latinos who are deserting the Democratic Party are Latinos who are not particularly religious, number one, and number two, who have the least ethnic identification.
Interesting.
So the lowest levels of ethnic identification. So Democrats make a mistake and they say, we were losing votes on Latinos. Let's go talk about immigration, because they're talking to people who are least ethnically identified as well and aren't particularly concerned about immigration. Those are the Latinos that we're losing. It's not over choice.
Just to follow up on that, because I think that's really interesting. So how do you get at this issue of more and less ethnically identified as a Hispanic voter?
So there are questions that social scientists have developed that you index together to get to this. So they ask, for example, how important is it to you, how important is your identity as a Hispanic to you? And there's a scale of that. And to what extent do you feel that what happens to other Latinos in the United States affects you?
A
great deal, some, not too much, not at all. So again, there are questions that measure the importance of your ethnicity, what's called shared fate, that is the notion that you suffer this or have the same fate as others with your similar ethnic identity. And you index those questions together and you get people who are more ethnically and less ethnically identified.
That's really interesting. I mean, basically what it's showing is that it's not a great variable then. And so maybe there's some other variable that group has in common that explains this.
Exactly.
And is there an answer to that? I mean, usually the answer is education, right? Is that non-white voters are experiencing the same sorting that white voters have experienced in lower education are becoming Republican and higher education voters are becoming Democrats?
Well, and partly it's ideological. Partly it's habitual, that is not having habits, so being more open. So all of those things enter into the equation.
Interesting. All right. Thank you. We learned a lot. It's a good conversation. Last question, also from a pollster, turns out. Kellyanne Conway. I assume Kellyanne Conway still considers herself a pollster and is doing polling, which she certainly used to be a pollster. We had her on the show last week, and she asks, if you weren't doing this and you weren't living in Washington, D.C., what would you be doing and where would you live?
Well, I tell you what I would definitely not be doing, but would like to be doing. Love to be a singer in a rock and roll band, but that will never happen.
Do you sing at all?
No, I can't carry a tune in a bucket.
And you don't play any instruments?
And I don't play any instruments.
So this is just total fantasy.
This is a fantasy that I have no chance of achieving.
But something like you actually in the back of your mind, like, are you a big music fan?
I'm a music fan, and as Peter Palmieri said, music speaks louder than words. So
do you go see live music?
Sometimes, yeah.
What was the last concert you saw? Or a recent one that you enjoyed?
Bob Dylan. I see Bob Dylan a lot.
Oh, did you see him in Baltimore a few weeks ago?
No. I'm in New York.
How long ago?
Last year.
Oh, yeah. I saw that tour too in D.C. Maybe. And man, he was getting up there.
There are those who say he can't sing either, but he's still much better than me.
Absolutely. No, the voice is... Well, that's a whole other conversation. Thank you for doing this. And so next week, you don't know who the guest is going to be, but give us a question for them.
Who will be Donald Trump's vice presidential pick?
That's a good one. That's a good one. I say J.D. Vance. How would you answer that one?
I don't know. I mean, I would think that he would want to pick a woman, and particularly a minority woman. But I don't know how who he's going to find.
Yeah, it's slim pickings in the GOP right now.
That he hasn't already ruled out. So.
Yeah. Well, Mark, thank you very much for a great conversation. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate it. I hope it was okay.
Good stuff.
And that's our show. Our producer is Kara Tabor. Our senior producer is Alex Keeney. I'm Ryan Lizza, host and executive producer of Deep Dive. Our music is by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Tell us what you think of the show or who you'd like to hear on Deep Dive. You can email me at rlizza@politico.com. And please subscribe to Deep Dive wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.